This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You've heard the reports. Almost 65% of adults in this country are overweight or obese, and about 15% of kids and adolescents, too. The estimated cost of all of that fat runs to $70 to $90 billion a year in medical bills. There's plenty of blame going around. Genetics, television, our sedentary lifestyles all come in for criticism. But many health advocates say that government is part of the problem and needs to be a big part of the solution. They propose a range of possibilities, some highly controversial, like taxes on fat content or bans on junk food advertising, while other ideas are lower profile, like forcing fast food outlets to post nutritional information. Later in this program, we'll talk about the effect of sprawling suburbs on sprawling waistlines and see how the fattest city in America responds to its unasked-for label. But first, part two in our series on obesity, the debate over the role of government in the fight against fat. What do you think? Should government take active measures to help Americans be more fit? If so, how? Government, personal responsibility, and the politics of fat. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Kelly Brownell joins us now. He's director of the Yale Center for Eating Disorders and Weight Loss, the author most recently of Food Fight, the inside story of the food industry, America's obesity crisis, and what we can do about it. He joins us from the broadcast studio at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
You say Americans live in a toxic food environment. What is that in the first place, and what's government's role in creating it?
Toxic is a pretty strong word, but I think it's justified here. We basically have allowed an environment to take shape in America that's a perfect recipe for obesity. If this environment were transplanted to another country, there would be obesity there too. In fact, that's happening in country after country in the world. And the environment has made people physically inactive and has pushed unhealthy food on them in a very big way. And the consequence, as I said, is this predictable epidemic of obesity. Mm-hmm. Government has played a major role basically in its inaction. It's been many years this crisis has been brewing. It's been ignored by the government. In the meantime, national nutrition policy has been heavily affected by the food industry. And as a result, we have big problems on our hands.
Well, what are the kinds of things that you think government should do?
Government could do any number of things. Tomorrow, the U.S. Department of Agriculture could get snack foods and soft drinks out of schools. This is a huge problem. Schools have essentially become addicted to this money. The soft drink companies advertise in schools, promote their product in schools, and sell a lot of their brand loyalty to kids at very early ages.
Does the government that does that have to go back to tell the teacher that just lost his job why he got fired?
There are some examples now around the country of how schools have taken out soft drinks and snack foods and haven't lost money because mm-hmm. they've replaced them with healthier options that kids actually will eat. So the schools appear to be dependent on the money, but not as much as you'd think. That's one thing that the government could do. Another thing the government could do is to regulate food advertising aimed at children. The average American child sees 10,000 food advertisements a year. Nearly every one is for a food like candy, soft drinks, snack foods, sugared cereals, and the like. It's important that that change because there's very little to counteract it. There's almost no promotion of healthy foods that kids are exposed to. So even the most intrepid parents find it hard to protect their children from these influences.
Now, another thing you've talked about is the federal food programs that already exist, a thing like food stamps, for example.
Programs like food stamps and Head Start and the WIC program, which is the Women, Infants, and Children program, feed many millions of people every day, and they've been quite successful in correcting the problem they were originally designed to change, which is undernutrition or malnutrition. But in so doing, they're now contributing to the obesity problem by giving people unhealthy foods and too many calories. They could be a big part of the solution if they were conceptualized as a way of dealing with the obesity problem.
One of the things, interesting points you made in your book was that a lot of these programs were designed when starvation, lack of food was the major problem, and now that's not the problem.
Right. Even the poorest people in our culture now have access to food, and so money is not such a problem anymore in terms of getting enough food. It's partly, and this has been a success of American agriculture, is food is available at very low cost in the United States. But as a consequence, people can get very many calories with very little money, and we have obesity as a result.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are other kinds of things, and I guess the most controversial one is the so-called Twinkie tax, the fat tax. Well, how would that work?
Neil, there's a basic problem here that unhealthy food is convenient, it's accessible, it's heavily promoted, it's engineered to taste very good, and it's cheap. This wouldn't be so much of a problem if the same things were true of the healthy alternatives, but sadly, the healthy food is harder to get, it's less convenient, it's not promoted very much, it doesn't taste as good because the food technology people haven't gone to work on it as much, and it's more expensive. So one way to change this economic imbalance is to reduce the price of healthy foods, basically to subsidize its sale. But in order to do that, you have to have funding from somewhere, and one way to do that would be to be put a small tax on foods like soft drinks and snack foods and fast foods. This is now being done, by the way, in a number of states, but the money has never been earmarked for anything related to nutrition. It's just been used to raise general revenues for a state or be used for road repair or something. Mm-hmm. So if these taxes could be put in across states around the nation and the money were specifically earmarked for promoting healthy eating, I think we could have a big impact.
So it would be less a deterrent tax the way it is to some degree on tobacco, where the price is really jacked up a lot to prevent, discourage people from buying it, and more of a nuisance tax?
We know from research on both tobacco and alcohol that large taxes really are a deterrent to consumption. So at some point, the country might get so upset about the poor diet and obesity that it's causing that they would be ready for a tax like that. I don't think they are right now. Mm-hmm. But if they were, it would probably work. In fact, several states have imposed taxes in the range of 7% to 9% on things like snack foods. And the snack food companies have screamed because they say they're losing money. So apparently those taxes work. But the taxes that are that big tend to get repealed for a number of reasons. Maybe at some point they'll be around, but I think probably what is possible now are small taxes. Say a penny a can on soft drinks would raise $1.5 billion annually in the United States. That's a lot of money. That's enough money to pay Shaquille O'Neal to advertise carrots instead of Burger King, and Britney Spears to do orange juice rather than Pepsi. Then you could really have an impact.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And our guest is Dr. Kelly Brownell. He's the author of Food Fight, the inside story of the food industry, America's obesity crisis, and what we can do about it. We're discussing what government can or should do about it, if anything. And our first caller is Ruth, who joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello. Yes, you asked about the government, and I'm not sure that government could do anything, and I'm not even sure that adding a tax to Twinkies. For example, there's been so much in the paper and on the news lately about obesity, and yet yesterday's paper, the Oregonian or a radio program said the most popular food item at the state fair that just closed was deep-fried Twinkies. And but I think doctors need to be involved much more. I mean, you're not mentioning doctors talking to the families. And
well,
a lot of people don't have health care.
Both good questions, both good programs, both programs we've done at other times and will continue to do. Right now we're talking about whether government should be involved. And I guess Kelly Brownell, somewhere in Ruth's comment there, was a question about personal choice. I mean, you know, people want to eat what they want to eat.
You're very right. Ruth did raise an interesting point. No one thing is going to solve the obesity crisis. The food industry is quick to say this. For example, they'll say a food tax isn't going to solve the obesity problem. Well, of course, nothing by itself will solve the problem. And so when Ruth mentioned involving doctors, I agree with her absolutely. There are any number of things that have to be done. The personal responsibility is a very interesting issue. I believe personally that personal responsibility as the default solution is the way our nation is set up and probably the best way to approach all problems. But sometimes personal responsibility doesn't get the job done. Tobacco is a perfect example. We could implore parents to ask their kids not to smoke. We could ask adults themselves not to smoke, and we do those things, but it's not enough. And so we forbid smoking in public places. We put high taxes on cigarettes. We do a number of things to try to step in and do something for the overall public health. And I think we're to that place with food now as well. The personal responsibility just isn't getting us far enough, and something has to be done.
As you've pointed out, though, in your book, tobacco and alcohol are voluntary. Food isn't.
Food is not voluntary, which is absolutely correct, except that eating unhealthy food is, and eating healthy food is as well. And so we need to create an environment where it's easy for people to make healthy choices. Right now, it's very hard. If I'm on my way home from work today and I want to stop and get healthy food, but I don't have much time, I'm going to have a hard time finding it, and it's going to cost me more than the unhealthy alternatives. That's not the environment that we should be exposed to, and it's not the kind of environment we owe to parents. By the way, the advocates of personal responsibility, and I gather you're going to be talking to some of them later in the program, come up completely short when you ask them what they would do about the problem, because they thump their fist on the table, they say we need more personal responsibility, and then when you ask them what to do, they have nothing to offer, because what do? You're going to implore people to have more personal responsibility, have campaigns, education. Well, none of that stuff is working, so we have to do something else.
Well, let's go to Larry, and Larry joins us from Aiken, South Carolina.
Hey, Neil, it's an honor to be on the show.
Thanks.
I'm a weight loss consultant. My observation is two things that people are very confused about weight loss, and they often focus on ideas other than the basics, which are to move more and eat less. And then secondly, people use, number one, that they focus on all these other ideas as a convenient way of avoiding the basics. People don't want to move more, and they don't want to eat less. I think government should be very much involved. As your guest is talking about this environment that people are in, if you want to make people obese, we are doing everything possible to create that reality. We need to change the environment to help people not be obese.
And what particular measures do you think the government should do, Larry? I mean, should they be coercive, as in taxes, taking money out of your pocket?
Everything. Taxes, the changing of the WIC program, encouragement for the food industry to change its ways, and every other innovative idea possible. The magnitude of this problem is such that we have to approach it as we approach other issues of the same magnitude, do everything we possibly can, and do it energetically.
Well, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Neil, could I make a quick comment on that?
Go ahead.
There is coercion going on right now, and the coercion is going from the food industry and the government that's colluding with it to encourage people to eat unhealthy. When the average child sees 10,000 food commercials a year, that's coercion. That's persuasion of the worst sort, and there's nothing to counteract it. So in my mind, if you provide healthy alternatives to people, promotion of healthy foods, labeling of foods at restaurants, and those restaurants don't want you to know what's in their food, by the way, that's not coercion. That's creating a healthy environment, and I think all Americans deserve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those are sort of positive reinforcements, and government, as we're going to be talking about later, can also do a lot more in terms of saying, get out into this wonderful park and take a walk or go for a run or ride your bicycle and do all those sorts of things. And educational and exhortational cures, I don't think anybody really has an awful lot of problems with. It's when government seems to be getting into your kitchen or getting onto your restaurant menu.
When government can help you eat healthier, I don't find that as being intrusive. If I go to a restaurant like Outback Steakhouse or Fridays or Chili's, and I open the menu and I see how many calories I'm going to eating in something, I hardly see that being an intrusion on personal freedom. And if the government helps make healthier food cheaper for my family and me and for other people in the country, I don't see how that's intrusive, coercive, or a power play by the government. I think it's helping offer the population, especially parents, a healthier environment for their children.
We're discussing obesity and the role of government. What do you want the government to do for a slimmer America? If you have an opinion or an idea, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the role that government should play, if any, in the fight against obesity. Our guest is Kelly Brownell, the author of Food Fight, the inside story of the food industry, America's obesity crisis, and what we can do about it. You're invited to join our discussion at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. The state of New York has a couple of bills that target obesity pending in the state assembly. One is a type of junk food tax. The other is what Jim Todisco, a Republican state assemblyman, calls a carrot to keep New York fit. And Assemblyman Todisco joins us now from his office in Schenectady, New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, it's great to be with you today.
Tell us about your proposal to keep New Yorkers healthier.
Well, basically, there's a couple questions we're asking ourselves as a government. How much should we involve ourselves in people's lives in terms of directing them for better behavior in terms of obesity and eating and affecting our medical costs? And I think there is a role to play. The other question is, should we penalize them for what we deem as poor behavior, bad eating habits? And that's what one of my colleagues wants to do with a fat tax.
This is a Democratic Assemblyman Felix Ortiz.
Right. He wants to penalize basically a lot of poor kids who eat a lot of hamburgers and take that money and recycle it and provide them with an educational program, which may or may not work. I think my approach and some of my colleagues who are supporting that approach makes a little bit more sense, and that is have government reward people for positive behavior, in this case, exercise. And this bill is called Fitness Income Tax Credit. And what it would do is provide kids to get involved with Little League, baseball, karate, dance groups, fitness clubs, fitness equipment, but also any age group at any level. This would be a reward through a tax credit, and if individuals fall below the poverty line, that tax credit would go to the business or industry which provides that recreational opportunity. So it's a win-win, I think, for our kids and for our families and for adults. It's a win for business and industry, and I think it's a win for government, because when people exercise, when they involve themselves in this activity, when they keep themselves healthy and not obese, their medical cost goes down, and that affects all of us in a positive way.
Do you oppose the Assemblyman Ortiz's proposal, which, as I understand it, would impose a 1% state tax on junk food and soft drinks?
Yeah, I oppose that. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me to tax poor kids for buying hamburgers and hot dogs and french fries and then try to recycle their money to teach them not to do that. I mean, we've tried a lot of educational programs for smoking for drinking and driving, and they've been partially effective, but they haven't been fully effective. I think rewarding people for positive behavior, in this case exercise, makes a lot more sense than penalizing your constituents for not illegal behavior, but for behavior government deems as inappropriate, and that's eating a lot of fatty food. There's no question there's a problem with obesity. You know, we've got stroke, we've got heart disease, we've got juvenile diabetes. And if we can do something to direct people for more positive behavior that impacts this, I say let's go for it. But I think we should reward them for the positive behavior of exercise. And that's what the FIT bill does, Fitness Income Tax Credit. It's a positive reward. It's a carrot approach rather than hitting somebody in the hand with a stick if they try to buy a Twinkie and eat it.
Just to cast you for the moment into the role of a political analyst, what would you say the chances of either bill's passage are right now?
With the economic situation such as it is, it'd probably be very difficult right now. We have to be able to have, it's just like anything else, when you can make an investment in the short run that impacts you positively in the long run, that's a great thing. When you don't have the money to make that investment, you can't make that type of investment. We had a $12 billion deficit this year. We're not like California, which is up into $30 billion, but we have our set of problems. The economy is not fully turning around. But I think in good economic times, if we can make that investment of a fitness income tax credit in the long run, it's going to actually save us dollars, bring more money into the state coffers. Because as I said, when people are not obese, they exercise, they stay slim, their medical costs are less, and that impacts all of our premiums.
Okay, Jim Todisco, thanks very much for being with us today.
Great to have been with you, Neil. Thank you for the time.
Jim Todisco is a Republican state assemblyman for the state of New York, and he spoke with us from his office in Schenectady, New York. And I wanted to get back to Kelly Brownell, and this is in the context of an email question we got from Lou in Marana, Arizona. I don't have a weight problem or health problems related to fast food or Twinkies, he writes. Why should I pay taxes, etc., on my snacks because of the weaknesses of others?
It's a very good question that, of course, we have to address when we talk about taxes. By the way, I agree with one thing, several things the representative said. One was that penalizing people for making specific food choices makes no sense unless the money that gets raised from that is put toward making their lives better. So if a poor child pays a little bit more from a Twinkie at a 7-Eleven, but that money that gets used to subsidize healthy foods, then I think we're fine. As a culture, we do a lot of things to where we're not affected. For example, I might brush my teeth and floss regularly and not have a problem with cavities, but I'm willing to pay the money to have fluoride in the water so that it benefits the common good. We pay more for gasoline, even if we don't drive very much, because it goes for bridge repair and highway repair. We have a lot of things we do like that. So my guess is that the public might be willing to put up with very small, almost imperceptible taxes if the money were being put to good use. If it's not being put to good use, I don't think the public would support these taxes at all.
Let's get a caller. Scott joins us now from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, I just wanted to call. I guess I was, when I was listening, I found it somewhat offensive to have government again try and do the role of big brother and try and tell anybody and everybody how they should eat and what they should eat. I find that absolutely remarkable that want government to try and start doing that.
Well, I think one of the things, Scott, that health advocates are talking about when they talk about such things is they're saying government already plays a role in helping you decide what to eat by the way they price things.
They're already playing too big of a role.
So you think that they should get out altogether, at least if not doing any good, certainly do no harm?
I think they probably would eventually do more harm than more good, like they do in practically everything they get involved in.
So you would object to even, laws, the big taxes against tobacco products, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes back to the role of the person and each individual, and everybody is responsible for the decisions that they make. And government tries to play such a big role in everybody's part, or everybody's lives, and for me it's just becoming really very offensive and very intrusive. And a perfect example of what's going on now or looking at, and again, maybe I'm changing the subject a little bit, but bottled water, which is becoming a huge, huge industry, if you look at the labels on bottled water, the labeling is so, you have drinking water, you have distilled water, you have purified water, and
Scott, I'm going to agree with you, Scott. It's a little off the subject, so we'll leave you right there. Appreciate the call, though. Getting back though, Kelly Brownell to his larger point, and this is, I guess a philosophical argument about the role of government that you're going to run into as these proposals get debated more and more in state legislatures.
Funny as it sounds, I agree with Scott. Government does a lot of things wrong. Nobody wants Big Brother. Nobody wants the government telling us how to lead our lives. So I find that a perfectly defensible position. But if you embrace that position, then you're basically left with this epidemic of obesity with tremendous human suffering as the consequence. We have children now under the age of 10 who are getting diabetes. The disease that used to be called adult onset diabetes has had to be renamed to type 2 diabetes because children are getting it. These children could start losing their eyesight or need coronary bypass surgery by the time they're in their 20s. So there's tremendous suffering going on. So if you embrace the get Big Brother out of our lives personal responsibility position, then you're basically accepting the status quo that hasn't been successful. And then we have to accept the human suffering that comes from it. If you're not willing to accept that suffering, then you have to think about what can we do in the way of public policy to change this, because I see no other way to approach it.
Joining us now from his office here in Washington, D.C. is Rick Berman, Executive Director of the Center for Consumer Freedom, a nonprofit organization that represents restaurants, food companies, and concerned individuals threatened by what they describe as extreme restrictions on food choice. It's good of you to join us.
Thank you.
As somebody who represents restaurants, what problems would you foresee if there are laws requiring nutritional labeling at restaurants?
Well, the first problem is that it's totally impractical. You can imagine restaurants that have a special for the day having to send out the information on that special ahead of time for sampling, for sodium content, caloric content, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact, if you get beyond fast food restaurants, In a lot of cases, the food is not prepared exactly the same way. Portion sizes are somewhat different depending upon how much sauce they put on a particular meal. Or, in fact, whether or not you have a hamburger cooked medium rare or well done is going to change the fat content. And what you do is you set these restaurants up for litigation because there are all of these groups out there who like nothing more than to pick up five samples from five different restaurants that have the same menu labeling, show that the nutritional content has varied, and then suggest that there's some actionable cause here because you advertised it one way and there was, 20% more calories.
Well, surely adults can come to a conclusion of, a typical Big Mac is equals, or that...
You would think. But in fact, we've already seen indications of a lack of flexibility in this area. But there's something that I don't want to miss, Neil. I just came on to the program and didn't hear very much of what was being said before.
Always a problem.
I know, but that's okay. But it goes to this point. It goes to whether or not people are being reasonable when they first make their assessment as to what needs to be done versus what happens down the road. I just heard Kelly talking about, and I will quote him, he said, there shouldn't be anything wrong with, quote, small imperceptible taxes. And these small imperceptible taxes are not what he writes about in his book. In his book, he speaks about large snack taxes that can generate considerable revenue and appear to drive down sales of these foods. This is part of the problem. People come in with one statement. They're trying to win the public over with getting the camel's nose under the tent, but their main agenda is to do something far more draconian and far more invasive and pervasive. And so one of the things that we need to think about is not what the going-in position is, but what is the ultimate position for some of these people who are trying to control what individual responsibility ought to be looked at as the real cure for any of these problems.
We're going to let you go in a minute, but I did want to ask you, to turn the coin just a little bit. Restaurants do play a role in obesity. There's no question about it. Portion size, the advertising, a lot of stuff that goes on. Yeah, we go in and we put down our hard-earned money and we buy it. But do restaurants have a role in this? And if so, what should they do to help cure it?
Well, everybody understands that when you go in and order a soda, you can order the diet soda or you can order the sugar, the real sugared soda. Everybody understands that you can order the smaller size hamburger or the larger size hamburger. Everybody understands you can order the salad or you can order the larger servings of something that's obviously more fattening. Individual choice is available to everybody, and the restaurant's role is to provide what consumers want. You see people ordering more salads now in the fast food industry because there appears to be more consumer demand for it. Mr. Brownell can tell you himself that he has admitted that his own obesity is related to the fact that he was very sedentary while he was writing this book that he's on the book tour with, and he admits that lack of exercise and snacking has resulted in his own weight gain. Now, this is a personal responsibility issue. The restaurants that he went to, I'm sure, offered doggy bags if he wanted to take a smaller portion size home. And when we get away from that concept, when we keep thinking that the provider of a service is the guilty party rather than the consumer of the service, we're already on a very dangerous slippery slope.
Rick Berman, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Rick Berman, Executive Director of the Center for Consumer Freedom from his office in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Dr. Brownell, I guess you get a shot back.
Well, I think when the public begins to see the behavior of the food industry, the personal attack that just went on is an example, they're not going to like what they see. Now, Mr. Berman's group, the reports are that it's been funded jointly by tobacco company money and food company money, and then he goes out on behalf of these companies and makes statements about personal freedom, and let's not change anything in that industry. And then the companies that don't admit that they're funding this kind of group get the benefit from it. So, for example, there was an article, an editorial in the San Francisco Chronicle recently, very critical of Mr. Berman and his group. And And somebody from Outback Steakhouse came in to defend Mr. Berman. So I'm assuming, I may not be correct, but I'm assuming that they helped fund his organization. Now, the public needs to know that Outback Steakhouse is funding this sort of slimy behavior by this group that dresses itself up in the name of personal freedom. And when the public knows this, and Outback's going to get a black eye for doing this kind of funding, I think they'll withdraw the money, and then the groups can speak for themselves, and they don't have to have this front group where the money is hidden. It's not hard, by the way, to label items at restaurants. It's quite easy. It could be done tomorrow if we wanted to have it done, but those restaurants want you to know how much fat, how much saturated fat, and how many calories are in their foods, because people wouldn't want to go there then. So he's defending a bad practice. It's an intrusion on personal freedom to withhold that information, not an intrusion to demand it. We should know what we're eating when we go to restaurants.
Let's see if we can get one more caller in, and let's go to Craig, who joins us from Grand Junction, Colorado.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Basically, I just want to make the point that, you know, ever increasingly these days, fast food is being sold and marketed through schools in our public education system, and it seems incongruous to me to try to educate children on better eating habits when they can get McDonald's and Taco Bell and whatever in their school.
Hmm.
And plus, they have captive marketing on Channel 1 for Pepsi, which they also advertise junk food on. So it seems like it would break down there at some point.
Let me add, if I could, Kelly Brownell, a email question we got from Ginger Wireman in Richland, Washington. Why, she asked, does the USDA run the school food program rather than the U.S. Department of Health? It seemed there would be a direct conflict of interest because they subsidize growers.
I absolutely agree. This is an example of the premise that you began the program with. The government is contributing to the obesity problem in many ways, and that's one of them. By the way, I agree with Craig. I think he made a very good point. The schools are not a safe nutrition environment for parents to release their children into. The schools can change, in many cases have, and I think the kids are going to be the beneficiaries of this, and we'll probably have kids doing better in school as a consequence.
Well, Kelly Brownell, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Brownell is the director of the Yale Center for Eating Disorders and Weight Loss, and he's the author most recently of Food Fight, the inside story of the food industry, America's obesity crisis, and what we can do about it. He was with us from the broadcast studios at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. When we come back from a short break, the link between where people live and their waistline. A new study says sprawl is bad for your health. If you'd like to join us in that part of our discussion, our phone number remains the same. It's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address. That's the same too, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.